You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On the early morning of March 6, 1993, an intense fire broke out in a tiny nursery. 16 minutes later, firefighters had extinguished the blaze, only to reveal the room burned so severely, everything was virtually unrecognizable. Then they were told to look for a baby. What they discovered looked more like a monster from a horror film. The small skull had been incinerated and the legs and arms were nothing more than charred stumps. The only identifiable human feature was the baby's genitals covered in what remained of his diaper. Two people were home at the time the fire broke out, the newborn's parents. The arson squad declared the fire suspicious and the homeowner's insurance company hired investigators who determined the fire to indeed be arson. The prosecutors wanted to dismiss the case, but the arson unit had a newly appointed prosecutor who refused to do so. Was it arson? What was the motive? Along with the tenacious and determined Detective Leslie Van Buskirk, Diane Marger Moore persisted for more than 2 years to find the truth and get justice for baby Matthew Wise. The book that we're featuring this evening is 16 Minutes. Was the death of baby Matthew an accident or murder? With my special guest, author and special prosecutor, Diane Marger Moore. Welcome back to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Diane Marger Moore.
Thank you, Dan. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about the book and the murder.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about this extraordinary book, 16 Minutes. This is particularly heart-wrenching story, of course, because the baby involved in this, and let's get right to this story. We realize that you were a special prosecutor. I just introduced you as that, and in the brief synopsis of this book, we understand a little bit more about your role in this. Let's talk about Marion County Prosecutor's Office, and your boss, Chief Trial Counsel, called you and asked you if you knew anything about Brian Poindexter dismissing an arson murder case against a guy named William Wise. Tell us, as you do, yes, as you introduce in this book, that conversation and what you learned as a result.
Scott Newman had just been elected prosecutor in Marion County, which is Indianapolis and surrounding areas, and he hired me as the chief arson prosecutor for the county. Cale Bradford was his chief counsel, and Cale called me. I'd only been in the office a very short time, and called and asked whether I knew anything about an arson case that had never crossed my desk. It was in the hands of Brian Poindexter, who had been a prosecutor with the prior administration and probably the one before that, so he was sort of a good old boy prosecutor. I knew nothing about the case, and so I immediately picked up my telephone to try and call Brian, but he failed to answer the phone. A few minutes later, I was called into a meeting in the small conference room that we had in the prosecutor's office. And at the meeting was Cale Bradford, supervisor, Poindexter, and two detectives with the Indianapolis Police Department Homicide Unit. And right, it was at that meeting that I learned about the case.
And what did you learn about this case and the reason why this Brian Poindexter was willing or wanting to dismiss this case?
Well, the detective who was involved as the primary in the case, Leslie Van Buskirk, was intent on pursuing whoever started the fire in the baby's nursery. However, Poindexter was aware that the arson unit, that is the one connected with the Indianapolis Police Department, had referred to the fire as suspicious rather than as arson because they were unable to determine the specific cause of the fire. On the other hand, the insurance company had done its own investigation, hired some very qualified experts, and they had determined that it was arson. So Poindexter, fearing that there would be conflicting evidence, had decided that the case, which was already completely circumstantial, could not be won. And so he was getting ready to dismiss the case after discussing it at length with the hired defense lawyer, of whom I think he was a little, well, let's say the defense lawyer had an excellent reputation for winning in court.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you talk about Jimmy Voiles. This is a defense lawyer. What are you shown at that meeting, as well as the information that you are is imparted to you?
Sure. Well, I knew Jim Voiles, and that was neither here nor there to me. What was most powerful about this, about the meeting and about the case, was a photograph that Detective Van Buskirk put in front of me and demanded, "Where's Waldo?" And it was a picture of the nursery that looked very small, and one could not see anything except for char and rubble just a few inches off the ground of the room. I mean, there was a stick or two of other things, but in general, everything was burned to the ground. And she kept demanding that I look. And as I looked at the photograph, which was, by the way, you know, blow up 8x10, I could see in a small corner a little white speck. And as one looked closer and closer to that photograph, there were tiny genitals of a male baby under that diaper. And when she told me that the fire had only burned for 16 minutes, I knew, as the firefighters on the scene knew, that there was something terribly wrong.
What was decided, what did you decide that day as a result of that meeting?
We asked Mr. Poindexter to leave the room because his decision was not controlling. I thought that perhaps my boss would make the decision, but he deferred. And I decided that I had to do at least further investigation before making an ultimate decision to dismiss a case where an 8-week-old child was killed. And
right.
That was the decision.
What information did you get about Ray Ann Simons?
Well, it was after the investigation had been going for a while and I was getting to know Detective Van Buskirk, who I had never worked with before. She was in homicide and I was in arson. But she mentioned to me that the father of the baby, there was something horribly suspicious about the way he looked. She said he had eyes that never blinked. And I asked her how she knew that, because it would be rare for her to have spoken with him. And she said that it was from a video that she had received from the Elkhart Police Department, which was really surprising. Why would Elkhart have a video of this person? And it was at that point that Van Buskirk described to me that the father of baby Matthew had been the primary suspect in the killing of a very young teenage woman named Rayanne Simons, who had been pregnant with twins that they believed were his.
And how was she found? What was the condition that she was found in?
She was found beaten and thrown in a grassy area. What everyone knew was that she had met with William Wise, the name of baby Matthew's father, the evening before, that he had been the last person to see her alive. And then he had indicated that he wanted to help police. And when police focused on him, he claimed that he had an alibi witness, and that alibi witness was the mother of baby Matthew.
Yes, Michelle. What did you say to Poindexter regarding this case?
I really just told him that the case was no longer his, and that we would do what we thought was appropriate. Dumping the case, or attempting to dump this case, this very important case, right after a new prosecutor was elected, I perceived as a political play, but more important than the politics, because politics are irrelevant to me as a prosecutor, more important was the willingness to allow someone to have killed an infant and not even attempt to obtain justice for that baby.
Now, to understand this case, you had to look at all of the available information. So how do you start with this? And before you start that information, well, that journey to look for that information, what is the just basic story or statement that William Wise said that fateful day?
I wasn't present, of course, when William Wise was questioned, but Wise kept pointing to the fact that he thought the fire was started by a baby monitor in the child's room, and he claimed to have spent a great deal of time supposedly trying to rescue the baby. And that was his claim. He had told Michelle after she did a number of things, because they had a fire alarm in the house and the fire alarm was going off. He had told Michelle to go and call 911 from another location because he claimed that the telephone service was not working.
Right.
So what we began to do is, of course, try and look at that story and piece together what had happened. And very quickly, and from the file, I was able to determine, and this is from the work that Lesa Van Buskirk had done previously, that the fire had started and been put out within 16 minutes. And that was determined based on witness testimony who had seen the house early that morning and what Bill Wise said. He claimed that he had gone to the bathroom. He was upstairs where the baby was. This was a split foyer house, so there was an upstairs and a downstairs, that he had gone to the bathroom that was right down the hall from the baby's room at 5 o'clock, and the fire was out. So anyone who's had any dealings with fires knows that it takes a lot longer for a fire to totally disintegrate a room than 16 minutes.
Right. First responders, firefighters, and police officers, I'm not certain, I can't remember who arrived first, but what was the response from William noted by these first responders?
Well, the first person that we know of that came to the house was actually a police officer He was a motorcycle officer, and he had been cross-trained as a firefighter in North Carolina before he'd moved to Indianapolis. He immediately ran to the house, and he noticed two things. One was that the front door was open, which is the last thing that anyone trained in fires would do, because it allows more oxygen to go to the fire. He was able to see that the fire was upstairs coming out a window. And when he saw Bill Wise was dressed in what he thought was firefighter uniform, a hat, coat, boots. And Wise told him that there was a baby inside. What Wise never told him was that it was his baby. And Wise never, anywhere in the investigation, referred to his child by name. He only called him the baby.
Yeah. You also found someone that delivered newspapers, a woman. So you talk about this 509 Michelle called from a neighbor's house 27 seconds later. He called from a different neighbor's, and he had ran to two neighbors' homes. He was impatient at one, went to another at 5:10, and you say the fire was out by 5:16. What about this newspaper delivery person? What did she have to say in terms of time?
So her name was Cynthia Newitty, and what she was is she was helping her son on his newspaper route. They had a very tight schedule because she had a full-time job. She was always very careful in the early morning hours because it was dark and she was female, and she was wisely careful about her surroundings. And so she delivered a paper to the house next door. She parked nearly in front of the Wise house, and the baby's room was on the street side of the house. She says that she saw no flames, no fire, nothing at 5 o'clock, which was consistent with what Bill Wise claimed about being in the bathroom. But what we know is that between that time and when Wise allegedly was running from house to house to call 911 is that he and Michelle were in the house for a number of minutes, supposedly trying to turn off the fire alarm. Why not run up and get the baby? Instead, they were on. They were trying to get the alarm off. Michelle ran up and down multiple times, finally going downstairs to get her shoes on to run across the street. And when she called 911, she never mentioned that her child was in the house. So it was a very prompt response by firefighters. And one of the issues was if Bill Wise was only 27 seconds behind Michelle, and we knew that no attempt had been made to save the baby, what could he possibly have done in those 27 seconds? And we know that what he did was run to one house, knock on the door, not receive a prompt response, and then run to another house.
Yeah. You made a request to get to hear those 911 calls, but I know this is maybe not chronological order here, but what do you discover in terms of where he was employed, his employment, and that connection to that 911 call?
Sure. It turns out that we initially found that Bill Wise was actually a dispatcher for the fire department. He worked at what was called Mecca, and he knew all about how 911 calls come in, how they're responded to, how quickly they'll be responded to, and he had been working there for quite a while. We also know that the night before the fire, he had been grousing about the fact that the baby cried all the time.
Right. And so the idea that you also find witnesses to say, to talk about his marriage to Michelle, the birth of this baby, and then you also just mentioned that his complaint was that this baby was always crying, and getting his wife to get up and respond to this baby. Tell us a little bit more about just some of the people that you find and this testimony that that speaks to his behavior.
Sure. Well, by the time I'm involved, it's now 2 years after the murder. For reasons that are far beyond me, Wise had been permitted to be released on his own recognizance, and he and Michelle had been out and about in the community. They'd actually moved a couple of times. And so what we started doing was piecing the information together concerning his relationship with Michelle, the mother of baby Matthew. And in doing that, she had worked in a bank in Indianapolis. She was a very plain Jane, not likely to have dated much, bank teller. And her colleagues at the bank knew very little about Wise, except that he had urged Michelle to have an abortion. She got pregnant. And he had strong control over her, and she had an abortion. It was at that point that they supposedly broke up. She moved back to Elkhart. He claims he was dating other people. And then the issue of Rayanne Simmons came up. So we knew about that. And obviously at that point, Michelle and William were back dating since she was his alibi. And shortly thereafter, or at least sometime thereafter, she got pregnant again, according to the bank folks, because we couldn't find any other friends of Michelle. Her banking colleagues again said that Wise wanted her to have an abortion, and this time she refused to do so. When they married, no one from the bank and no one from Mecca was invited to the wedding. So whether it was what one would call a shotgun wedding or not, I don't know. But William Wise came back to Mecca and said that he was married and that Michelle was having the baby.
Yeah. In this investigation, you also find out that the insurance company, Allstate, didn't have to do what they did, but they did an extensive investigation themselves and went one step further and created a replicate burn room. Tell us about Allstate's involvement and what you learned.
Allstate did this fascinating thing that insurance companies rarely do. I mean, the Wises had only bought this house a few weeks before the fire. And so other than their down payment, which we understood was very small, the rest was the mortgage. And so Allstate, whether the house burned by fire, by arson, or by some other cause of a fire, was going to have to pay off the entire mortgage. Despite that fact, the representative for Allstate had to know what had happened in this nursery. And so he convinced his company, Allstate, to hire Barker Laboratories, a very well-respected laboratory, to create not only as close as possible the same room, nursery, but also to fill it with the same type of items as was in the actual nursery. After they paid for that and they had hired a fire cause and origin expert and an electrical engineer to look at various causes, because in his statement to to their lawyers, Wise had again claimed that the baby monitor had caused the fire. Allstate had these this laboratory recreate a fire as if it would have started from a baby monitor. They actually took a torch to the same model and make baby monitor that Bill Wise was blaming, and showed through video recording what would have happened even if what he said was true, what the room would have looked like at 16 minutes, at 20 minutes, at 30 minutes, at longer, 45 minutes. That video was conclusive that after 16 minutes, if the baby monitor had started the fire, which we later proved it could not have, but if it had, that after 16 minutes, that room would have been 90% intact, that this fire, based on conditions in that nursery, would not have spread that quickly.
Right. What about the issue of alcohol, rubbing alcohol, and its merits?
So both the fire investigator from Indianapolis Police and the fire investigator from Barker and Herbert Labs, both of them concluded that the fire had to have been accelerated by some form of accelerant. And people generally think of accelerants as gasoline or some sort of fuel or oil or petroleum product. But in this case, one of the things that we knew is that there had been alcohol in the nursery, and the question was, could that have been the accelerant that Wise chose to use? And, you know, being the skeptical prosecutor that I was, and I guess part of me still is, I wanted to know if alcohol could burn. Got once, but I'd never seen it. And so I actually, with some of the fire department personnel, lit, and I'm talking about rubbing alcohol that you'd have in a baby's room. And interestingly,
right,
it does in fact flare up instantly. And so that was one of the issues, was because we didn't have a gasoline can found somewhere, did Wise use alcohol to accelerate the fire? And the actual, whether it was alcohol or not, was never actually determined.
Let's fast forward to the point where you have enough information that you can put this information towards a court and decide whether there's enough evidence to proceed to trial. And you say that Indiana has a unique situation. Tell us about that.
Well, in Indiana, there is I'm not sure I understood your question. I apologize.
Well, all I wanted to do was to determine the process that you were able to finally say, yes, we have enough evidence. The judge could agree that you were able to proceed to trial. But you mentioned something about Indiana having a different approach than other states in that process. But
sure. Well, certainly in this case, because Brian Poindexter had had numerous conversations and hearings with the court, with Jim Boyles present, there was a true issue about whether or not the case should be dismissed. And the judge had an attitude that, based on what he'd heard so far, that it was likely that the case would ultimately be dismissed. And we had to essentially convince the judge that that was not the case. The other major issue in this case is that the evidence was all circumstantial. We know, meaning prosecutors, that circumstantial evidence under the law is just as powerful as direct evidence. But on TV shows, in commentary, people who are not involved with the law frequently think, oh, your case is only circumstantial, meaning that it's not legitimate or that you cannot prove it. And the answer is, with circumstantial evidence, you can prove a case. You just have to do so piece by piece by piece by piece, proving the evidence is sufficient to convince someone, and by someone I mean 12 jurors, because Indiana requires a unanimous verdict of 12 jurors. Other states have different requirements or lesser requirements. So that's what we were trying to do, and it was really a point at which, when did I feel we had enough evidence that we could persuade the jury, knowing all of the evidence that might be excluded, when did we have enough evidence that I believed we could convince the jury that one of these parents murdered their child? And we finally got to that point in our investigation.
Right. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is Talkspace. When you're in a low point, you might feel alone, but over 50% of Americans struggle with their mental health. Many years ago, I was feeling depressed, and I reached out for help, and I was glad I did. We all need help sometimes, and asking for support when you need it is actually a sign of strength. Talkspace makes it easy to match with a licensed therapist and schedule live video sessions, all from the comfort of your device. You can start messaging your therapist the same day you sign up. Whether you are experiencing depression, anxiety, or other problems, Talkspace is the number one online therapy platform to help you sort through any issue. Thousands of licensed therapists are available for you to match with. Talkspace therapists are experts in dozens of specialties, including anxiety, depression, relationships, and more, to help you start feeling better. Start feeling better with a single message. Match with a licensed therapist when you go to Talkspace.com and get $100 off your first month with the promo code TRUEMURDER. That's $100 off when you use code TRUEMURDER at Talkspace.com. Now, Diane, we were talking about all the evidence you gathered, all the things that you learned in preparation for this prosecution successfully, you hoped, of William Wise. One of the things we didn't mention was there was some controversy, and you anticipated that the defense might use this or try to use this, so you, anticipating that, tried to counter it. And this was the idea that the Fisher-Price baby monitor created this fire, caused this fire. So we won't go into the whole thing about the transmitter, but you did have that part of the investigation to be able to determine that that this Fisher-Price unit could not cause a fire, and that as well, there was a Nightline program as well that you perceived or decided that William Wise may have watched before this incident ever occurred. Tell us about those two things, please.
When I first read the two statements that Wise had given, one to the fire investigators and one to the Allstate lawyer who was involved in representing Allstate Insurance Company, he had referred to the fact that this baby monitor that was in his child's room was the only cause that he could think of. Why was he focusing on a baby monitor? It seemed like such an unusual suggestion, and I couldn't figure it out. And I kept thinking about it, and it dawned on me that he had to have heard about it somewhere. And so ultimately, we found out that in Indianapolis, there had been a show at a time when Wise was likely to have been watching TV because he was on a night shift, that talked about a different brand of baby monitor that had indeed caught fire and caused the death of a child and injured the father of that child who was trying to save him. So the Barker and Herbert Laboratories, and because we had the electrical engineer involved, we requested that they let us know whether or not the baby monitor could have caused the fire. And there were many reasons, completely logical, but also just plain science and physics, that the baby monitor did not have enough electricity going to it that it could possibly have caused the fire. And that's because it had one of those, the boxes that you put into the wall, and you may wonder what it is when you attach it to appliances. It's called a step-down so that the amount of electricity going to the baby monitor was so low that you could, I mean, that power wouldn't be enough to start a fire.
Right. And the Nightline episode as well, you realized that they were going to use this, and they did use this at trial. And why I bring this up is because it's an example of your astute prosecution here. And tell us a little bit about when this witness testifies about the Nightline program and its contents, and then what you do as a result. Very, very fascinating.
Well, the defense had hired an expert that was going to talk about the fact that a baby monitor could indeed cause a fire. And they used a couple of videos concerning it and also knew that they were, we had tested a number of baby monitors and all of them had a certain wiring. They had a glob left from the fire that was dissimilar to what we had been testing. And when we found that, and we found that out, and it was really sort of mistakenly almost, we went back and obtained a bunch more of the baby monitors and found out that when they were manufactured in three different countries, they could be slightly different, and so we tested all of them. But what we ultimately found was that when the expert that they had hired was using a video, that he was had hand-selected parts of the video. We asked to see the entire video as we were in front of the jury, and we got to show them the rest of the story, which was the actual parts of the video that were relevant. It was then that
right.
They sort of switched gears and claimed that something else had started the fire.
This trial began on July 31st, 1996, a three-week trial. You provided experts. You had David Lepper, Steve Shand, which was a cause and origin expert, and then you had John Pless, a pathologist. Tell us about the crucial witnesses and the information at this.
Okay, well, you left out Jim Finneran, who was the electrical
right.
engineer, and it started where we put on the experts, that is Lepper and Shands, to talk about the fact that they had excluded every other cause of the fire, which is what one has to do in an arson case, so that we checked out every light, everything that was plugged into an electrical outlet, the electrical outlets. We actually brought the outlets into court so the jury could see them. These experts showed that they ruled out everything that could have caused the fire, except And then we brought in Finneran, who was wonderful about showing the jury why the baby monitor could not have caused the fire. In fact, Finneran had the jurors step down, and he, after he plugged in the baby monitor cord, he cut it and put allowed the jurors to touch it so that they could see that there was inadequate electricity going to that. You would never do that with a regular cord because you would electrocute yourself. So he did that, and then came sort of the most imperative and shocking testimony, and that was from Dr. Pless. Dr. Pless was the head of medical examiner. He taught at Indiana University Medical School. He was the head of the pathology department. And Dr. Pless gave his opinion after examining all of the evidence that someone had actually poured an accelerant on baby Matthew. And that is why baby Matthew was incinerated to the extent that he was. He told the jury that the reason that the little piece of diaper was still in place, and that because it had soaked up the accelerant, it had actually protected the baby's genitals because it is the fumes that light and not the liquid.
Incredible. Let's stop for a second for these messages. So essentially, he said that this baby was burnt alive, was accelerant was poured on the baby and then lit on fire. Correct?
Yes.
Yes. Now, in this prosecution, in this trial, you get through this, you have capable expert witnesses, the defense voils, does an admirable job or a capable job, but can't really shake your fact witnesses, as you write. It gets down to you learn more at the sentencing. You find out more information about his background as a result. But then there is a mistake. There is an oversight regarding the Rayanne Simmons case transcript. Tell us about that.
Oh, it was horrible. First, we knew we'd have a very uphill battle because the O.J. Simpson verdict had come in right before our trial started. It had caused a great debate in this country about the criminal justice system. We knew that that was going to be problematic, but we got through the trial. And Voiles had a very unique technique. He actually sat in front of two jurors during closing argument and only talked to them. And when the jury went back to deliberate, I've got to say that I was exhausted from a three-week trial. I think the defense was exhausted. Voiles had another lawyer with him at the trial. I had Van Buskirk. And we looked at all the exhibits that were supposed to go back to the jury, and we erroneously allowed a transcript that had talked about the Rayanne Simmons murder case. Unfortunately, but it talks about the quality of the jurors we had, which was exceptional. Some of the jurors read that, and that information was inadmissible. The fact that he was suspected in another murder case was highly prejudicial, and the judge declared a mistrial.
Of course.
The other thing that happened when Jimmy Voiles was doing his closing argument is that he tried to blame, or he placed blame on Michelle as a means of creating reasonable doubt, but it was effective.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll never know. We understand that the verdict at that point, and they hadn't really deliberated, we understood that at that point in time it was 10-2 for conviction, but you can never rely on that because jury deliberations really involve jurors discussing issues and persuading each other as to the facts as they heard them. So that's how that trial ended.
Now, you say that there is no double jeopardy clause here, so you can certainly retry William Wise. And you said what you just talked about, you did learn something from this, so it wasn't a total waste at all, and you're going to retry this. But there's Police Chief Allen's case, and you resigned at the end of the Shane Allen trial. Could you explain why and then how you were persuaded to come back and try the Wise case, and by who?
Double jeopardy didn't apply in this instance because it was not an error caused by the prosecution.
Right.
And so while double jeopardy always exists, in this case, because the defense was equally responsible for looking at the exhibits to go to the jury room, we were permitted to retry the case. Retrials don't happen that often, but I was insistent we were going to do this. And I was then promoted and received an assignment. And I guess I will just say that my boss became aggravated one day, the elected prosecutor, and let me say that he said and did things that were enough that I resigned what would have been effective immediately, but it was on a Friday, and I had been preparing a very major murder trial, a murder committed by the chief of police's son, Shane Allen, and I was not going to let the family of the victim down, and so I stayed until I convicted Shane Allen, and that was my last day in the office.
Right. Now, with this, Voiles, the defense attorney, he's gone, and somebody that you know, Mark Ernest, is on with a couple associates as well. You find out there was talk of Wise having a girlfriend, which was a firefighter, and so you got to talk to her. Tell us what you learned from that conversation with her.
Sure. You know, it is not an element of a crime. Motive is not an element of a crime. So the prosecution doesn't have to prove motive, but everybody wants to know what someone's motive is. I want to know what somebody's motive is. And certainly a jury, when they're considering, that a parent might have killed their baby, wants to know what the motive is. So we were looking even after the first trial, we had to determine the true motive and, of course, look into Michelle. So one of the things that we did was we had heard from colleagues at Mecca, where William Wise had worked, that he had dated a firefighter. And we were interested in that. And so we tracked her down, and she conceded that she had dated William Wise. And we asked if there was anything unusual in their relationship. And she pointed out two really important factors. One was he always kept firefighting gear in his trunk. And she couldn't understand that. And she was a firefighter and had been for years. We asked, did you keep your fire gear in the trunk? And she said, of course not. So, and then we found out that, one, he had been a firefighter in the past, and two, that it was his idea. He had talked to her a bunch about the fact that if he came upon the scene of a fire and rescued somebody, that the Indianapolis Fire Department would hire him as a firefighter. And despite the fact that that was unlikely, she convinced us that William Wise was convinced that if he was a hero, the IFD would hire him. And that, we believe, was part of his motive.
Incredible. Less shocking, but you also find out about their wanting to have $1 million lawsuit and suing the makers of the baby monitor. But there was a conversation that occurred with this person that's involved in insurance 2 weeks after the funeral. Tell us about this statement made.
As this case got a great deal of press during the first trial, after that trial, we were contacted by an attorney who worked for the state of Indiana, not in the prosecutor's office, totally separate and apart from that, who was a cousin of the Wises. And she described what she found as a pretty shocking conversation that she'd had with Bill Wise only a couple weeks after the baby was killed. And in that conversation, Wise had told her that lawyers had related to him that he could get millions of dollars if he sued the manufacturer of the baby monitor for causing baby Matthew's death. And he asked her as a lawyer whether her opinion was that they could get $1 million. The fact that he was considering the amount of money that he could get for the baby's death shortly after the baby's death caused her some serious concerns.
You talked about your expert witnesses and then their defense team trying to break them down. John Pless, again, from the first trial, is your expert witness again. You did very well prosecuting. They didn't do as well to try to counter the witnesses you brought. In 1998, May 1st, he was sentenced for murder. Tell us all the charges he was convicted of and the sentence. Before we talk about some of the information that you learned, again, through his mother about William's background and fire and his relation to fire.
Sure. Well, although I'd left the prosecutor's office, they asked me to come back. I was in private practice. They asked me to come back as a special prosecutor to prosecute this case. Special prosecutors are brought in from the outside on extremely difficult or hard-to-win cases. And because of how I felt about this case, I accepted that challenge. I certainly wanted to come back and do it. And so the sentencing, so at the second trial, William Wise was convicted, and he was convicted of murder, felony murder. Felony murder was a charge that we added that was somewhat controversial with the defense, because our position was that if for any reason the jury believed that Michelle had started the fire, that the actions of Bill in allowing the baby to die was felony murder. And arson as an A felony, which arson causing death. So those were the original charges for which the judge was going to sentence him. The judge recognized that two of the offenses, murder and arson causing death, could merge, That is, that the sentences would have to run concurrently. And so in her sentencing, she said that if she had not sentenced for an A felony, she would have given X sentence for a B felony, arson. And those were the charges for which she entered a sentence.
And the idea, too, you write that the accomplice liability, they talked about the first trial and tried to accuse her, basically, of being the murderer. But you write that this accomplice liability, if she did it, then Wise, William Wise, is an accessory, correct?
Yes, and that would be, in Indiana at that time, one did not have to specify whether someone was the principal murderer or an accomplice murderer under felony murder. So in this case, we did not have to do that, and it was never the jury convicted on all charges, and so it was not it was not a problem.
Mm-hmm. Does the jury in this sentencing and this when people get to make their statements, including the defendant, is that where they find out about the Rayanne Simmons case and his connection?
Well, the jury really never found out about that. What happened is the jury has no part of sentencing in Indiana at that time. So at the conclusion of the trial, Bill Wise was taken into custody. His family was present. He asked for a pre-sentence investigation, which is done by the probation department.
Right.
And the judge set it for sentencing where she would make the determination as the appropriate sentence to give him. And so the judge knew about the Rayanne Simmons case peripherally, but there were a number of factors that she did not know about that she learned about at sentencing, we believe, or in the sentencing memo.
I see. So in the conclusion of this trial, obviously Detective Van Buskirk was essential to this. What was your takeaway from this after this trial as a special prosecutor?
As I walked away, I thought a great deal about could I consider this a victory? And how can anyone ever consider it a victory when an 8-year-old child is dead and will never come back? Years later, as I was writing this book, I went to the cemetery where baby Matthew Wise is buried. And what I found there in the children's section was a totally uncared for, obviously ignored, just stone in the ground with his name. And it was the only child's burial spot that didn't have a teddy bear or flowers. It looked like no one had visited it. And that was heartbreaking. And so what I'd say I felt was that I hoped that this child and that family understood that we had gotten justice for baby Matthew.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I want to thank you so much, Diane Marger Moore, for coming on and talking about 16 Minutes. Was the death of baby Matthew an accident or murder? Thank you for your extraordinary effort to have this person prosecuted and brought to justice. Thank you so much. I know this is a Wild Blue Press release. Is there an Amazon page, Facebook page that people might take a look at this? Tell us about that.
Yes, there is definitely, it's definitely on Amazon. 16 minutes won't get you there, but 16 minutes colon was the death of baby Matthew will get you there. And there is also a Facebook page, 16 minutes. I really appreciate this opportunity. And Dan, I appreciate your reviewing the book and reading it and allowing me to speak to your audience. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much, Dan. It's been an absolute pleasure. And it's such an important book and an extraordinary book. Thank you so much for coming on and telling us about 16 minutes and this incredible prosecution. 16 minutes, was the death of baby Matthew an accident or murder? Dan Marjoramoor, thank you so much. You have a great evening. Good night.
You too. Good night.